Welcome to another episode of Double or Nothing. Michael Frazis, can I just say, you are looking fresh as a daisy. It is pouring wet outside. Have you been caught out in the rain? I don't know if you was seeing this. I don't know if I'm going to share this on YouTube. You've either come back from a swim out in the pouring storm or out of the rain, but I don't know what it is, but it's all happening on the screen today.
No, I'm actually on my way to a St. Vincent's hospital function after this. So.
Okay, nice. Yeah. A charity thing?
Yeah, been involved with them for a while now, actually. It's been kind of interesting.
Oh, good man. What are we there's a lot going on every week in the increasingly tumultuous world of financial markets and geopolitics. What's been on your mind?
There is, you know, I think there's a bit of a change in the markets now. I think the kind of bear phase that we're in most recently from mid-August till basically about a week or two ago is kind of changing. The reason for that is you're starting to see pretty sharp reversals and everything's kind of off the lows. Now, this year has been one of the years, like my kind of style is when things are down, I like to buy. That's like always my bias. But this has been one of those years where that style, but usually that style serves you incredibly well. Like you're kind of buying on the way, on the days everybody's selling.
It serves you well in a 10-year bull market. It serves you well in a 10-year bull market.
If you're in a two-year bear market, then it's the wrong approach because a year and a half later, everything could be at lower prices. But I'd say that there's been two phases. There was kind of like May, June at the lows to kind of mid-August where that completely reversed. And then you're kind of seeing, and then there was back to bearish price action. And now once again, you're seeing things get bid. And I think there's reason for that. Like treasury yields have kind of certainly come off. There was the first inkling of a crack in the labor market. So very much in a bad news is good news moment, but the job openings kind of dropped quite significantly. And there was a small increase in layoffs. And it's really been like, it's a mystery. One of the mysteries of this period, or it's not really a mystery. One of the features of this period is there's been falling prices almost everywhere you look with a few exceptions, you know, whether it's shipping rates, all kinds of commodities, with the exception of maybe Australian coal and lithium, including energy. All kinds of prices are falling, but that hasn't shown up in the statistics. You know, home prices are falling. Rents have even started falling in the United States, but really hasn't shown up. And most of those indicators they look at are lagging. So I'm wondering if at some point, maybe now or maybe at some point, you know, in the future, at some point there'll be a moment where the official statistics still look bad for inflation, but actually we've already rolled over. And again, looking at like agricultural commodities, prices across the board, the fact that, you know, 9-month shipping delays are now down to less than a week, you know, there's been a huge shift. It just hasn't appeared yet. And I do wonder if the market's starting to front run that and why, you know, so many growth stocks are so significantly off the lows now.
I just noticed New York Times, so Paul Krugman had an article in New York Times saying we should expect low interest rates again soon. So I guess he's on the same bandwagon that basically the whole inflation thing will peak or has peaked. I haven't read the article, so I'm just going by the headline. Yeah. But that seems consistent with what you're saying.
And you've seen two kind of pivots, or maybe three if you include a Bank of Japan, who hasn't jumped on the rising rates bandwagon, has defended their currency. You saw England, you know, step in decisively and switch from quantitative tightening to quantitative easing, basically just buy the government debt without sterilizing it. So just outright purchases. And then you kind of saw in Australia, in the RBA, it made front pages overseas in international financial media, where the RBA went up 25 bips instead of 50 bips. So you're starting to see, and then there were quite a few academics and economists who came out in support of that overseas. So you're starting to see a bit of a change, and who knows, right? Like this year has been a feature of, you think that a shift in all these things is happening, and then all of a sudden there's a red hot inflation number and everything just reverses again. So it could be that. You're definitely starting to see more and more signs that we might be over that particular hill.
What's your read of the 25 bip raise? I kind of saw it as capitulation and kind of, you know, caving into homeowner concerns. But I think
going as fast and as high, like this has been the fastest raises since the early 80s. So you're talking about 40 years. It's worth noting that, you know, like there's a principle like first do no harm. And generally that's been completely ignored by policymakers across the board, whether it's like mass lockdowns or the easiest policy ever to now one of the fastest tightenings ever. It's, you know, it's there's a certain recklessness and it's balanced, right? I'm also like the easing was reckless, certainly in the later stages, and the stimulus when there was no need for it. similarly, you could definitely argue that rising rates this fast, when you know that it comes with a lag and you know that there hasn't been enough time for the initial very substantial, in the US, 75 basis point rate increases to have an effect, there is like a case for actually like just not going absolutely ballistic. You know, you can be, and again, it comes to being, there's like a level of nuance it's almost impossible for a politician to be nuanced. Like a politician has to speak in Australia to say 25 million people. You have to keep your message simple. The central bank is also, central banks are in a similar position. You know, the Fed might be nuanced in their speaking, but they can't be nuanced publicly. You know, they have to say inflation is number one at the moment. But the reality is these things do require a level of nuance. They're highly complicated. The impacts of all of people's actions, particularly significant extreme actions, which we've definitely seen, is not predictable. So I think you're seeing people like the RBA, you know, kind of just step back a bit. You know, just because they're doing 25 and not 50 doesn't mean they're not going to continue to raise rates, you know, but it does mean it's a bit more measured. It's a bit more time for everything to adjust. It's a bit more time for prior rate rises to take effect. So I definitely think it was the right move. Because damage is being done, like significant. I'm sure you've seen those charts where this has been like the biggest destruction of wealth, which I've certainly personally felt in those big charts. I'm like, I wonder how much of that is.
Yeah, like 3% of Australian wealth destroyed is your portfolio. No. I think it's probably property.
You have to laugh or you cry.
it's probably property prices, right? Like, I mean, they kind of zoomed on the way up, and everyone's like, we're the richest people in the world because, you know, we're just kind of paying each other more for property. And now, you know, it goes down, everyone's crying poor. And probably neither of those are true, because neither of those kind of real resource, real resource changes, but kind of price changes. So a lot's been going on in Ukraine and Russia last couple of weeks. I found it hard to follow, if I'm really honest. I feel like I'm not going to get the latest on the front pages of a newspaper, and I feel like it's very hard to pass propaganda and predictions. Everyone's been kind of wrong, and everyone's still kind of super confident. But I had an interesting conversation today. I caught up with the founder of a different private equity fund, a friend, and you know, he was concerned around nuclear event, and some of that his concern, not to be too kind of parochial and selfish about it, was really like, what's going to happen to debt markets if there's like a nuclear event? And obviously the human toll is awful, etc. But you know, it did make me wonder about the broader ramifications of continued escalation, and it's got to be. You know, concerning at this time. I'm glad I'm in Sydney, not in London or Kiev at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, it's terrifying. I mean, you play it out. I mean, this is Obama stepped back from intervening in Syria for this very reason. But if you look at the game theory of it, like Putin said, nuclear is on the table. The Americans, through General Petraeus and literally in the newspapers, have said, inclined that they would react to a tactical nuclear strike. So tactical nuke being a smaller nuke that might destroy a suburb, it might destroy a battlefield, completely dominate any conventional military, but it's not kind of world destroying or city destroying. It's like that next level up. You know, Putin's not a loser, right? He's escalated every moment, and he knows that he's got this trump card. And if he chooses to use it, the question is, will the rest respond? Because there's certainly a window where he can use a tactical nuke, win the war, or at least steady it, stop the declines, lead to some kind of stalemate that doesn't result in a response from the West. Now, the thing that scares me is, firstly, like that in itself is terrifying, but this was the outcome of, if you're at war with Russia, you just have, the reality is they have nuclear weapons. So I'm not saying anything in support of Russia's approach to the war or anything, just the hard facts that they've got this trump card, they can use it in war. But the Americans have said that they'll respond to that. And this is like in the Wall Street Journal by ex-leaders of major military operations like General Petraeus, that they'll respond by striking Russian targets in the Ukraine or outside, military targets. And so they're basically saying if there's a tactical nuclear strike, they will then enter the war. And there's no other way of, like, if you're striking Russian military targets, that is entering the war. It's highly unlikely to stop there. For example, one of Russia's nuclear subs are on the move. you know, and some of these are very kind of like the Chinese, like surfaced a submarine in the middle of an of American battle group very recently, like a few years ago, just to show that they could. A stealth submarine can do these kinds of things. And a stealth submarine, you know, armed with a nuclear weapon can wipe out a carrier group. You know, it's that kind of like battlefield clearance. So you'd have to think there's a good chance that they would respond if the West attacked. And the scary thing is there just seems no path out. It reminds me of, and I'm there's plenty of people saying this, but it reminds me of those times when people get in a frenzy, whether it's over lockdowns or even lockouts in Sydney before, maybe that's a step too far. But everyone's in a frenzy and it's all in one way. And, you know, I obviously have a very small Twitter following, but even I like tweeted something like, I hope this doesn't escalate kind of vibe. And you're getting people saying, yo, it's Chamberlain, you know, like kind of attacking, like, I think we should stand up for fascism. It's like, yes, sure. Like we should stand up. And Neville Chamberlain, you know, I mean, he's actually a pretty nuanced character, but you know, nobody wants to kind of surrender to the bad guys. But at the same time, you know, the worst thing that could happen for the Ukrainians, for all of us, you know, the worst possible outcome is a nuclear war. So if you have to like swallow some bitter pills to avoid that, I think they're worth swallowing. But there's just no, again, coming to that point of nuance, there's no nuance on the Western side by political leaders. They're all super gung-ho, seem to think that Putin would bluff about something like this. He hasn't been bluffing this entire time, as we've discovered. And you can actually see a very clear path where tactical nukes are used to win the war in Ukraine. If the West actually does what, if the West does not bluff and does what they're saying they're doing, and they're already getting pretty involved. I mean, they were boasting, NATO was boasting about the destruction of that Russian battleship was done with Western intelligence, effectively directed. That's like pretty serious involvement. You know, the Ukrainians are firing Western missiles and that at targets provided by the West. Like it's pretty involved already. But to go that next step would be an absolute disaster. So that's kind of, that is terrifying, because I don't think we've been this close to a nuclear conflict in a very long time. And certainly not one where you can see, the incentives for everybody right now line up in escalation. So for Putin, his kind of military, like the people to the right of him, the people on the front lines, they're calling for nuclear strikes. And that's, for them, it's almost kind of reasonable. Like they're shooting guns at the Ukrainians, they're getting shot back, they're losing now, they're dying, they're retreating. For them to call for their leader to use nuclear weapons is kind of what you'd expect. And if Putin goes, I think there's an idea that the Russians wouldn't shoot if Putin gave the order to do a nuclear strike. And we're talking about a small tactical nuclear strike that might turn the tide on a particular battlefield, but also kind of just scare everybody and potentially freeze the conflict. There's this idea that like the commanders wouldn't do it, but it's actually the opposite. It's actually, there's a chance that the military commanders, if they did do that, would be more extreme. It's like the military, it's the hardliners that are pushing for him to do it. Someone made the point, there's even a chance that like him not using nuclear weapons, him losing the war, is actually more risky for him. At the same time, for whatever reason, the West does seem to really want to escalate this. They're certainly egging on the Ukrainians. They're not using, there's talks of diplomacy is shot down immediately. It's just not being even discussed at the highest levels, you know, and it's very scary, because you can actually see the incentives of how this could happen, where each person's acting extremely rationally, and you end up in a nuclear conflict. And then the only way for that to resolve, other than, you know, in total disaster, is for the kind of nuanced negotiation and swallowing of bitter pills that no one seems to be willing to do at this stage. So it's very scary.
I mean, there's an enormous amount to unpack there. The thing that gets me is I don't know what Putin would get out of deploying tactical nukes. It's like the energy thing to Germany. You know, once you play that card, you can't really play it again. The threat of it's so much more potent. I don't think this is unprecedented. It reminds me a lot of the Korean War, where the US was very actively considering using tactical nukes. It wasn't as taboo as it is today. I read a great biography of Colonel Hackett, I want to say. I'm probably getting the name wrong. It's called About Face. And they're very explicit about using tactical news. There, the Russians were explicitly involved on the other side. Obviously, it was direct opposition to the Chinese. And, I mean, were people concerned? Yeah, they were absolutely concerned. This was like deep, deep kind of Cold War, but it's not exactly unprecedented. It's always hard for me to, you know, you said everyone's shooting down diplomatic solution. Who knows? Like, it's very hard to parse what's really going on the ground. You know, it's not obvious that the Ukrainians and the West should not press their advantage and Russia's kind of on the run, you know, like that doesn't seem obviously a bad idea, you know, and whether, you know, Russia while weak, you know, like they could lash out with nuclear weapons, but then, you know, that story doesn't end well for them either, you know, from a, you know, US obviously, you know, stronger from a conventional forces perspective as well as from nukes. So I don't know, like I'm way less certain about the, you know, the best path forward and what folks are or aren't doing. I am equally concerned, you know. I think your comment around doing everything we can to avoid nuclear war is very prudent, and that that's very important, but it's very not obvious whether that to optimize for that one or to exercise restraint or press strength. You know, I could see arguments on both sides, and it's always very, I really like your comment around Chamberlain being a nuanced character. You know, we don't have nuance in our historical understanding. We've got these kind of caricatures of Churchill and Chamberlain and the like around World War II. You know, whenever you really press on the detail of anything, really, on any side, it always gets much murkier and much more complex. And that is just not a part of kind of discourse. And so you can assume, you know, when everyone's kind of, trying to pull out one of these characters just for their position, it's like fake, like history is fake. You know, when you really dive in, it's just way more complex and more nuanced and harder to apply than these kind of caricatures we conjure. But anyway, that was,
Yeah, you must have done a bit of work on Chamberlain, because I know you've been reading about that period of history. Certainly.
So, I mean, like I read like, I don't know, probably a dozen World War II books, which isn't that much for the last few years. And recently they kind of, that probably escalate. You know, I read like a great Churchill biography by Andrew Roberts. And, you know, I read a couple of Hitler biographies this year. So I read a bit, honestly. You know, I feel like these subjects, you know, you read them and you realize how much you don't know. And, you know, you could kind of, you know, dive in infinitely on them, or, you know, you really kind of wrap your arms around them. So the more I read, the more I kind of caution you not to trust whatever I say, because it's probably wrong.
I'm always fascinated. The thing that fascinates me most is everybody, if there's like a deep impression of something, it could be anything, it could be a stock, could be like a person, and then you read a really convincing that actually it's the opposite to what everybody thinks. Like, I'm always like looking, love those situations, always looking for them. I don't know if Chamberlain is one of them, but I did read I'm trying to remember the crux of the argument. It was basically like he did everything he could for peace. Hitler ended up being more villainous than anybody could have. It was probably the ultimate villain in history, which gave World War II or the Allies legitimacy after the war. But let's say he was just less of a villain. The fact that Britain did everything they possibly could for peace also meant that every action they did in that was completely, justified. They're always going to be on the right because they did everything they could. And at the same time, you know, he had that famous thing where he came back from his meeting and said, you know, this piece of paper is peace for our time. But he then went and armed, and Britain wasn't ready for war, and it did buy time. And so while on the public, he was saying, look, it's peaceful. He wasn't actually complacent. He actually then ramped up the weapons build up as fast as they could, and did actually buy some time. So they're the kind of like little bits of nuance to Chamberlain, whereas now he's kind of a byword for
appeasement.
Yeah, and I guess you got to remember that these everybody in World War II was shaped by World War I. So everybody there, like committed, or new people that committed and had committed to them ultra violence, like over for years and years and years. It traumatized a whole generation, is probably safe to say. And so it's easy now to look back on World War II and say, should have done everything. But, you know, for them, the worst possible outcome would be another World War I. That was worth taking, like doing everything you possibly could to stop. And I personally, like, I don't think you can really fault somebody for doing everything.
Yeah. I think he was remembered better during his life than he has been posthumously. Mm-hmm. Like it's, I think you're right. I think the key thing in his favor is he basically just bought more time for the Brits to build up forces. I think the really interesting question, and not for this conversation, and I don't know what the answer is, the spiciest argument I've heard, and you know, who knows, is maybe, so if we kind of go back, all the stuff, myths you may have heard around Hitler really wanting to partner with Britain and effectively split the world in two. Obviously, you know, this is the age of the British Empire, okay? And, you know, Hitler really admired that. He didn't really want to go to war against the Anglos. You know, the war in the West with France, etc., was pretty civilized, excluding the kind of export and killing of the Jews. It was more or less a conventional Western war. Eastern
Front relative
different.
To the East, right? Yeah.
The Eastern Front was a war of colonization and brutality, and basically what the Brits and others had. And the French had done in their African and Asian conquests, but in the West it was pretty civilized. And so he basically wanted to do what the Portuguese and Spanish had done in 1492, where they split, they sat down with a map, they split the world between them, got the Pope's sanction, and went off and launched the age of exploration and conquest. Okay, and Hitler just, you know, and so kudos to the Brits for not simply splitting the world in two with Hitler, right? But there's a spicy argument that so obviously in World War II, Stalin ended up with this great empire. He had conquered a bunch of the East even before, you know, he had partnered with Hitler, conquered a bunch of the East. Before he partnered with Hitler, he had conquered a whole bunch of the Baltic and the Eastern states. And so by kind of partnering with Stalin and extinguishing Hitler, you had basically created the evil empire of the Soviet Union. You know, an alternative view of history is Hitler would not have been as radicalized, and you could have partnered with him to some extent to extinguish communism and then contained Hitler. Now, to say that, given what we know in the current unfolding history, is like semi-monstrous, because we know, you know, as you noted appropriately, Hitler's regarded as like the most evil character in history, basically. But it didn't need, would have played out like that. Didn't need to. Like, there's a lot to unpick there, and we're not going to like solve it now. I don't know if that's like a silly kind of counterfactual, but it's an interesting and spicy counterfactual that I think is massively underweighed today, and it's kind of interesting to think about. Anyway, we've done a World War II kind of accidental deep dive on our weekly finance chat, and you know, I think our listeners love that kind of thing. But what else has been happening in markets that we should talk about?
Look, I think the interesting thing will be reporting season's about to start, and even the biggest companies have been downgrading. It's kind of happened in two waves. So the tech and growth space that, you know, I mostly focus on, a lot of those EPS downgrades have been happening all year. In many cases, they've actually steadied. But it does give you a signal, because this kind of kicked off late last year. There was a reporting season where companies were kind of hitting their numbers, kind of inclining it might be a little bit weaker, but many of them were actually, you know, still very much on track and have been on track this entire time, and they're still getting smashed. The one like brief moment of respite we had was that period I mentioned, you know, after June, where there was another reporting season where companies like Shopify were coming out with outrageously awful results, and they were actually rallying on the back of it. And so I think that thesis I had, that it feels like the market tone has changed. Well, and obviously we don't really place bets on these kinds of things. This is just sharing some thoughts on the market. But it'll be interesting to see as reporting season starts and it's just about to kick off, what the actual market response will be to the numbers that the companies produce. Like, is it enough for these companies to be down 50, 60, 70, 80%? I think that the market reaction to their results will be by far the most interesting thing. So that's kind of like the main thing.
I've got a question for you. Oh, sorry, go. What's the other thing?
I was going to say the other thing is, you know, there's inflation numbers coming out and all that kind of thing that, and any one of those could, you know, there's been multiple times in the last year where a bad inflation number has put things into a tailspin. So that's probably the downside risk is almost certainly to that.
So, you know, over the medium term, say 12, 18 months outward, there are probably two kind of views I'm kind of vibing out there in the market. One is that inflation's peak, it'll be behind us, interest rates start to go down, and basically happy days, you know, share market boosts, etc. The other view is that, you know, there's this kind of grind down in stock markets and elsewhere, and this bear market is kind of prolonged for that period. And frankly, you know, with energy prices, with everything else, you know, there's basically a global recession in key markets, probably Australia, certainly the US, Europe. You know, Europe's about to go through a horrible winter. Geopolitical events, including Russia, etc., will continue to flare. You know, they're structurally, there'll be more regional conflict as the US kind of increasingly is inward looking. Both those kind of pull in separate directions. Do you think on like, you know, 1 to 2 year outlook, we'll be like kind of past the worst of it and happy days ahead? Do you think it's going to be tougher? How should we be thinking about all that?
I think interest rates are going to be really important. Like there have been huge moves, like 2.5 to 4 basically in the 10 year, you know, in like very short period of time. If they've somewhat peaked and settled around here, plus or minus 50 basis points, there's a good chance the repricing is behind us. And you got to remember the 90s and the 80s after the early 80s had multiple periods of rising rates, and rates were at a much higher level, even than they are today throughout much of that period. And that coincided with some of the biggest, you know, equity rallies, certainly dollar value ever. So it'll be interesting to see. The question is like, well, is there a point where equities start decoupling from that rising rate environment? There will be a point where that happens. I'm just unsure. I think it just depends. The impossible question is kind of what's priced in. That's really like the key thing. And then the geopolitical stuff, typically geopolitical events and, you know, an all-out nuclear war between Russia and the US would be an exception to this. But generally when things sell off on geopolitics, generally that's when you actually want to be using those opportunities to be buying companies for whom the geopolitics is actually completely relevant. Like geopolitics is very relevant to like risk appetite, whether people are flocking to cash, whether there's net buying or selling of stocks overall. But for example, think about an Australian company and an escalating war in Ukraine from here, where the world's already kind of adapted to the current status quo. How much will that affect a company in Australia doing business or even a company in the US doing business? Probably not a huge amount. And that's kind of, yeah, I mean, I guess the worst case scenario would be, and it's a very real scenario now, you know, is it's some mix of the tech wreck and 1973-74. And so the original tech crash in 2000, it was kind of like one and a half years down in tech. And then there was another leg down as the world went into recession and the markets bottomed after 2.5 years. You know, we're kind of, if you think about like the tech crash as measured by like that small mid-cap growth companies, you know, as measured by ARK or for example, we kind of were pretty invested in that space as well. That it all started for us kind of February last year. So already 1.5 years in. So if the analogy from the original tech crash holds, you'd then get a recession now, driven by rising rates, driven by all kinds of things that you can see. And you're certainly seeing slowdowns in the data. And then there'll be massive downgrades of EPS, probably more for bigger, the S&P 500, the big NASDAQ companies that actually were only down 20, 30, 40% instead of more. And that could go on for another 6 to 12 months. And then you'd get one of those like generational lows. So it'd be pretty gnarly for anybody to stay invested throughout. But from the lows, you'd get one of those opportunities like 2002, where you can pick up companies that go up 30, 40, 50 times. And there'll always be a big dispersion, right? So you're seeing in the market prices already huge dispersion between the performance of of stocks. So growth companies that have continued to hit their growth numbers, they're still doing 50, 60, 70%. They're all up significantly off their lows, even as kind of larger companies like Google and Microsoft sold off dramatically, you know, over the last few months. And so if the worst case scenario does happen, you really want to be searching through and finding those companies that are maintaining, you know, business performance and growing and doing really well. You know, I was reading an article from the end of 2002, and they were like, this is the end of 2002. So this is the worst case scenario a few months after the low, which was SEP 30 or around SEP 30 in 2002. And they're like, look, Amazon, Costco, was it Costco? Amazon, Priceline, and I don't know, I don't think it was booking.com. It was one of the travel companies had already doubled off the lows at that point. They're up 100%. Like, is that kind of it? And then they had the usual bull bear and people were saying the exact same thing, you know, earnings coming down, massively overvalued. You know, this is a good time to take risk off. It's a bear market rally, all that stuff. And that was like the end of 2002. Everything had already doubled off the lows. And then tech had the most brilliant 20-year run you could possibly imagine after that. So I think the worst case scenario could definitely happen at the moment. Like, it seems like this event after event just pushes you in that direction. But it's also worth noting what happened after that. You know, the companies that grew were pretty obvious to everybody. The difficult bit is the ones that grow will be up 50 to 100% of the lows, you know, even as the rest of the market pushes to a new low, which is already literally what you're seeing in the market now, where growth companies are up 30, 40, 50% from the lows. But indices like the S&P and the NASDAQ are just off their lows now. So that will be the challenge. The challenge will be then to actually, you're going to probably want to own the companies that are delivering best. They might have doubled from the lows. They'll still be down 50, 60% or 40, 50, 60%. They're probably going to be the ones that do best on the other side of this, whenever that happens. So that's kind of what we're thinking. In terms of, does it last another year? Or are we close to the end? It's just impossible to say. I mean, markets will bottom long before there's a reason why. That's always the case. It's just how they work. It's like they topped long before any of this, Ukrainian war, the red hot inflation, before any of that came, you know, markets had already sold off significantly. They will be ahead of it. So it's not easy. And sure. Then you're also getting, there's a lot of technical signals that have only flashed, you know, a handful of times over the last couple of decades that are flashing now, that are saying this is in line with the other six best times to buy stocks in the last 20 years. There's a lot of those signals flashing green. And to be fair, they flashed green like 3 months ago. And then we got a rally and then a dump. Growth stocks largely held, didn't go make new lows, but the broader market did make significant new lows. A lot of small caps made significant new lows. So there was at least one false start already. There could be more, but you're just seeing that, you know, and these are things like the number of companies trading below certain levels, max investor pessimism, obviously, but it's really those kind of like momentum indicators that are most interesting. You know, the other thing that's worth keeping in mind is there's a lot of machines at work. So machines basically work, but they're basically trend followers. So as things fall, they flip from long to short. The positioning is generally known to everybody, like whether they're 50 billion short, 100 billion short, 250 billion long. And, you know, so in November last year at the top of the market, they're all max long. And then as things sold off, you got this mechanical selling of hundreds and hundreds of billions. And then the lows in May, it's like, okay, they've done, you know, they're max short now. And we've got a huge rally. And then as things sold off again, and they all flipped long. So that rally in August was a mix of short covering and machines flipping long. And then you could see in the data, and again, you see this afterwards, you know exactly what happened after. Then you could see, you know, the stocks that are short squeeze sold off and the machines all flipped short with the market, and they pushed the market or helped push the market to new lows. But now you've got this, like, it's like the firewood's there. It just needs a reason to go up. And the reason could just be the price starts going up. And that encourages, you know, the trend following machines, of which hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars are allocated to start buying again. And there was a couple of pretty strong days. So it will be interesting to see whether that continues. Also, vol has come down. So as vol goes up, they go.
Who's the best person to, and maybe it's you, but in the world, just kind of think about how to measure and think about following flows, capital flows, because that's another way of framing what you just said. You know, machines kind of on auto buy, auto sell, but then you know everyone's kind of sitting on dry powder. Like I would have thought there are structural ways to follow flows and where the balance of flows lies to kind of really see, independent of kind of fundamental movements, what's kind of like, you know, which direction the market's likely to go.
Look, there's a couple of things. I mean, people you can speak with a lot more confidence about what's happened, because basically there's a very small number of banks that handle almost all these flows, so they see it, so you have very good insight as to what has happened. Which is why I'm talking with like at least some level of confidence as to what's happened in the past. It's much harder to predict in the future, but there are people that track. I mean, firstly, you know, they're very simple. At heart, they're momentum following. So as things move up above moving averages, they're going to be buying. There's a whole nother set of machines that are, I'm saying machines is, you know, like your Bridgewater, your all-weather fund. They basically adjust their entire exposures based on the volatility of the market.
Renaissance is a good example.
Oh, they're pretty opaque. I don't think they're simple. I think like Bridgewater, which I don't know if they still are, but at times has been the biggest hedge fund. Their whole thing is all weather, which is the name they've given to a strategy where they basically adjust the size of their exposures based on the volatility.
Haven't they lost a ton of money over the last couple of years? Or am I?
I remember they had a discretionary fund that didn't do well, but the main fund has risk parity. Like that idea is that you balance stocks and bonds. This has been the worst period probably ever for that strategy. Bonds have sold off at the same time, like government bonds have sold off at the same time. But you do know, like your question is like, how do you know about this? There's banks that track the actual flows. There's some really smart people at these banks that just basically recreate these models. And also, you know yourself, because you know when things cross key levels that most of the machines are going to be flipping one way or another. And also, you know that as volatility goes up, they're going to reduce their exposure to equities. As volatility goes down, by the same mechanism, they're going to have to increase their exposure to equities. And that's kind of, along with the trend followers, it's the vol targeting funds that kind of add a lot of like heat to these moves. And, you know, they went through a really rough patch up until this period, because in the bull market, basically everything kind of like lurched down, crossed the moving averages, everyone flipped short. And then, you know, within weeks, everything shot up and they all had to buy back at higher prices. Or in 2018, for example, it just bounced up and below, you know, the moving averages. They're just losing money on each big shift in momentum. This year has been different because there's just been this huge, like the trend has just been one direction down, you know, for the bulk of the last year. And so they've been some of the best performing strategies. It remains to be seen what happens next, of course.
So we've been talking about introducing a new segment, Double or Nothing, appropriately. How's it going to work, Michael?
I think we're going to have to think of a few topics and say Double or Nothing. I'd love to throw out some Aussie small caps that software companies to see. But given you work at a firm that's actively buying these out in the public market right now.
yeah. No, you'll trick me one of these. You'll throw one now and I'll accidentally spill the beans. Okay, well, do you want to kick it off?
Sure. Okay. What about Microsoft? Double or Nothing.
Okay, so and just for context, like we haven't actually pre-prepared this and I don't really know where it's trading. I guess like my overall, I think it's very hard not to be bullish Microsoft over like a 10-year view. You've had some of the sell-off obviously following what's happened over the last year. There's probably like an infinite way to run for Azure in terms of growth. They've done an unbelievable job over the last decade in terms of really owning the enterprise market and eating everyone's lunch from Teams to, you know, buying LinkedIn to. So they've kind of organically and through acquisition been super impressive. They've sold off. I think it's very hard to be short Microsoft over the next decade. So double.
What do you reckon? Yeah, I mean, they're just a monster. I think actually it's like the tech sector. You had the sharpest rise in interest rate in 40 years, which meant it was always going to be a really difficult time. But then there were a number of things that happened separately. You know, for example, Apple changed their advertising. That really, you know, drove the nail in the coffin of e-commerce and hit companies from Snapchat to Facebook, you know, just wiped huge amounts of value of everybody else. Simultaneously, Apple gained an immensely valuable advertising business. But one of the things that was challenging for the small mid-cap space was actually the brilliant execution of Microsoft. You know, they have, as you said, look the way they did Teams. You know, they just bundle everything. They create a product, bundle it with every business on the planet, basically pays them a fee. And it makes it really hard for them because they can just bring in a product like Teams, incorporate in their existing subscription. And then, you know, as night follows day, they'll just slowly, steadily increase that subscription rate. So it's a clear double.
Okay. Well, just on this exact subject, there's been a lot of noise this week around Google's kind of new product launches and how they kill a bunch of the products they sell. And there have been a few inside employees kind of talking about the hiring cycle and really how promotion driven these product launches are. So you really get nowhere by fixing stuff or whatever. That's why they've got like a gazillion messaging apps, because you really get promoted by launching something. And once it's launched, there's no love given to it and all the engineers kind of leave it. So I saw, for example, so when you said, you know, Microsoft done a great job in kind of bundling and growing these products, Google kind of really haven't, like their products kind of suck unless it's their cash generating Google search engine, which itself like query whether it's actually improving or whether the experience is declining and it's kind of getting worse. And so one small example I saw, you know, that they really recently launched like a Calendly killer. So you can basically set in your calendar your availabilities in the future, and basically for free you can kind of set it. And you'd think that Google should be able to kill something as straightforward as Calendly, but you know, it's not obvious that it'll be around in like 2 years time as it kind of goes through the cycle of launching killing apps. And so that's a nice counterpoint to your example of excellent execution on Microsoft's side. You've got this kind of broken system in Google that's just basically subsidized by Google's cash cow.
Yeah, I mean, at Google is actually interesting. I'd actually be more on the dollar side of Google, because Google is trading insanely cheaply and they do have those enormous cash cows. And I do think, you know, talking about like 10 times EBITDA, 5% cash flow yield this year, 6-7% next year.
It's pretty wild. You'd be buying anything else. Like in, you know, in Australia, you've got every Muppet in the universe, like investor, trying to buy something at 10 times EBITDA or 5% cash yield. You know, why are you not buying Google? I kind of get Facebook, you know, kind of the anti-network effect that some of its key products start to die. Maybe you don't believe in Meta. Maybe, you know, finally...
Zero nothing on Facebook.
Well, I think it's a much more binary outcome. Like I'd actually, like if you really press the gun to my head, I'd be a double on Facebook. Like, you know, I think Facebook's the dark horse. It's still founder led. You know, I think Zuck is an unbelievable weapon of a human being. And so you know, he's pivoted from web to mobile. He's obviously putting all his chips on Meta. I still don't really understand what that's going to look like. He's kind of bleeding cash like a wounded bull. It looks like ugly from a financial perspective. But, you know, he's still, you know, a $200-300 billion business. Can Zuck, you know, this you know, hero, this you know, entrepreneur, one of the like iconic entrepreneurs of the last two decades who still runs the company, can he build into something else? Like, I wouldn't want to bet against that. Like, if I had to bet, I'd bet on him. But, like, he's looking like the most binary here. Like, he, you know, Facebook may be kind of limping along in a decade and a half. It'll be, like, the most valuable company in the world.
Yeah, I mean, I still think I think, like, the issue is his social media companies and his platforms kind of are on the decline. You know, some you can see like they saturated the market and they suffer with ads. And for example, young kids don't really use Facebook in the same way that, you know, we did when we were younger.
Do you know what's I'm off Facebook, you know, like I'm not like, it's not just me. Like it feels like Facebook's actually declining. People are off it, you know, as you know, you know, we didn't have Snapchat or TikTok and stuff. I mean, you're probably snapping away, you know, but, But yeah, there's just a lot more competition. And
it was 2016, I think. It was 4 or 5 years ago where it started. Remember when they started ramping up the engagement? And this is what happened. You have a beautiful product, everyone's grandparents are on it, and they start ramping up the engagement, took all the money from the political advertising, big scandal. You know, that's when it started. That's when the whole outrage thing really took off. I think that's when it really started being, it wasn't a delight. It wasn't a place you went to. It was a place you went to and got angry about stuff. It wasn't a place that was like, it wasn't like a delightful experience.
Yeah.
Do you know what is interesting though? Yeah. I'll tell you what, is like when you reflect on TikTok and the rise of that, and then you think about Twitter, and Twitter shut down Vine, which is like a nascent TikTok. So you're talking about like Google shutting down product. Twitter basically had TikTok. They had the creators, they had the community, all the content was being shared virally all the time. It just needed a little bit of like love and care. And it was probably a bit before its time, before short video, before we all had these like 4K video, whatever you call them, recorders on our phone, video cameras on our phones. If they just kept that going, you know, they would have been perfectly positioned. There's every chance that that would have been TikTok, and then Twitter would have joined the big leagues.
I actually disagree with you. Like, I mean, yes, Twitter has basically effed up every single opportunity it's had over the last decade. But I think it could have won with Vine is like saying MySpace could have won, you know, yeah, the social media, yeah, they can't do the same thing, but the details matter. And like TikTok has just absolutely crushed its content generation and targeting algorithmically. And like to say you could just replicate it by giving Vine some love, I think is to like deeply misunderstand what kind of drives these things. And so, yeah, they stuffed it up and maybe they could have done better and they've kind of broken everything. But like, I think these things are so non-deterministic. It's very hard to have bet on anything. And you know, TikTok is what it is and it's crushing it. Where's Twitter Spaces, by the way? Is that still a thing? I haven't seen one come up in like forever.
I know there's a few finance people that do them all the time.
Okay, so they're still around.
They're like bear hangouts, people that think the world's going to end, and actually more or less called the last year very, very well.
They've been calling last year for the last 10 years. So
we'll see what happens. I think we're at the point where if markets continue to rally, we're finally at that point where everybody's short or out. And then you'll just have those, yeah, I don't know. Like things need to get significantly worse for things to deteriorate significantly worse. It could happen, but you know, at some point markets will put in a bottom, and then I wonder what happens to that whole community.
Okay, so I've got one for you. Double or nothing, Block. So obviously, you know, we're talking about Twitter, same dude. Bought Afterpay at the very peak. That looks very painful now in hindsight. Where's Block at?
They probably paid a similar amount to what Block is worth now. I mean, Block, there's a few interesting things about it. So it's trading something like 5x GDP. Like it's really trading as cheap as a growth company is going to get. On the flip side, the growth has kind of slowed down. You know, I think they did like mid-teen growth year on year. That is not good for that company. Now, there's some things to like about it. Like they're setting up an advertising business. There's still like a holy grail for them, which is that they've got the merchants and increasingly consumer app with their Cash App. And they can potentially bypass all kind of payment rails and the various like levels of payments you have to pay out and just be an extremely high margin business. The issue they've got is Cash App is only in parts of the US and it's mostly in kind of the South and like poorer parts of the United States. So the pro of that is you can argue they're underbanked communities. The flip side is, you know, haven't exactly won in New York, like people using Venmo there. So that's a key part of the bull case, has like a weakness. The other thing is on the Cash App, they do charge for like transfers in a way that seems strange in today's era. It seems strange to be charging, like Australian banks don't charge you at all to transfer money in and out of accounts. But a key part of their revenue stream is that. But this is one of those companies that was overvalued. They did a bad, disastrous acquisition for them. And then growth slowed down. And then they went from being actually at least profitable, not exactly gushing cash, certainly have stock-based comp, but profitable to like losing money on a net income basis. So all that happened, growth slowed down, disastrous acquisition, and going from basically making money on a net basis to losing money, all that kind of happened at once. But it is one of those companies that it's a relatively young company, and they've just built multiple business lines in the past, and they have all the ingredients there. You know, they have like a huge user base on the Cash App, even if they're not in the most affluent parts of America. Even with Afterpay, you know, they do increasingly have, you know, advertising options, demand generation options for retailers. Then they obviously have their merchant business, which is a great one. You know, you're seeing it in, not that it's hugely relevant to their share price, I'm sure, but you're seeing it in Australia everywhere. You know, and every time you kind of buy a coffee and you tap that little square thing, obviously they're getting a cut of that. So I'm kind of nuanced on that, but I do think that the best returns out of this, there's a lot of companies in that situation. I mean, how much is it down? I think it's gone from $280 to like $60.
Yeah. So
we're talking about huge, yeah, just under $300 to $60. So you're talking about 80% drawdowns.
I haven't even asked you. Twitter, it's going to be, you know, we haven't spoken about this. It's going to be a Musk company.
Yeah, I'm fascinated. I think he's going to do a great job.
Yeah, it's not really. I wonder, like, who knows? Like, it'll be super interesting what happens. Like right now, you know, will the Don come back to Twitter? It's really more of has more political implications than it has technical. Like, I don't know if you can suddenly increase the pace of innovation and improve the underlying product, maybe over like a 5-year view. But like, you know, you'd expect the censorship and the moderation to take a different flavor or to be reduced altogether.
Yeah, look, I think he's gonna make a lot of money out of this one, actually.
Do you reckon? Why is that? I want to hear.
He's got the audience. You're double. I'm definitely double if you could buy in with him.
Boom.
Because so
if I'm his financiers, I am like, you know, I'm pulling my pants, so to speak. Like you reckon? Like, I mean,
because apparently they pulled out. Apparently the who was it? Was it BlackRock or someone? Whoever they had lined up originally to do the finance.
I'm finance at the moment. Well, I would. I mean, like. The market fell like another like 30% or whatever, 40%, you know, since his bid. So he's, you know, paying serious money over the odds. You know, but that said, you know, that's a point in time, maybe again over 5 years if you could be bullish, and if he improves it, it should be a much more valuable company. But I don't know.
Like I'm just reading online now. They've major banks are committed to providing $12.5 billion. And face significant losses because they probably won't be able to offload that in this market.
Yeah,
that's another thing. That's another thing about these the interest rate environment. It's had a huge impact. Like the IPO market shut and credit market is not quite in severe distress. Not like a proper credit crunch, but it's definitely getting there. And that's not good, right? And it doesn't seem to be anywhere near the top of the list of Fed's priorities. But access of companies to equity and credit is really important. And I don't think you need to be like an ultra capitalist to agree with that.
I think there's going to be, I think that's going to be one of the key characteristics of the next 12 months. You know, companies raised a bunch of money 6-12 months ago. They're burning money. They've been looking for money and they haven't been adjusting prices. Now as they need to start touching capital markets, we've spoken to this a few times, both equity and debt. It's going to be expensive, that, you know, dilutive and hard. And I think that's going to be a big opportunity for new investors over the next 6-12 months. But we haven't really seen that yet.
Yeah, I think the issue is, so we're seeing a lot of things. We're seeing a lot of companies where the valuation has been marked down. This is in private, in our VC fund. The valuation has been marked down, but there's like, I don't know, a $10 million convertible or something. You know, a big convertible that was done at the top of the market. And the next round is, you know, kind of a convertible as well. So you can see the issues that's happening is like these companies just building up these stacks of convertibles, which I think it's pretty hard to resolve those.
Yeah, well, you'll eventually just get a restructuring or, I mean, they'll just be painful.
Everybody just has to take a
bath. Your money coming in. They'll just be, yeah, everyone takes a bath. It's just all recut.
does make it really hard. And it's also, it's tough because the things you want haven't come down immensely in value. But there's a lot of companies that might or might not make it. It's basically very, very difficult to invest in, if at all. Particularly with the markets where they are, where there's just no secondary avenue, no prospect, no confidence over whether they'll be able to list or whether things will tighten further. You know, it comes into that, you know, we're talking about central bankers earlier. If they continue on this gung-ho path, you know, financing companies is like off the table. Or they can take a huge, it's very hard to invest when you know there's like more tightening coming down the pipeline and things might deteriorate. What do you think? Do you think Aussie small caps will find a floor here, or is this too close to home? I mean, what are they trading at? A lot of software businesses are kind of 2x sales.
Yeah, I mean, overall, like, I agree with you. I think we spoke about this a bit last time. Like, I think as a class, they're attractively priced. I just think some of them, you just have to pick which ones will ultimately reach profitability and which ones will just keep bleeding cash and will have challenges when they need to raise more capital. And I think, like, in that context, you know, bigger the better. Overall, obviously, we're seeing opportunity within the press a few times over this. So overall, I'd say now is a good time to be buying. Everything we discussed indicates that right now is a point of attractive multiple compression, and you want to be selling in 2 or 3 years' time and buying now. So overall, I'd say that. But I think the details matter. Some of these companies look hard and look overvalued. Some of them look attractive relative to where we think they should be valued. I'm kind of speaking a bit obliquely, but I'd say, like, it's probably an area where the details matter.
Definitely. Why don't we wrap up there?
Awesome. That was really fun. Enjoy your St. Vinny's, you know, gala ball, fancy, you know, philanthropy shtick. You're like Bruce Wayne heading off, you know, leaving your Bondi mansion to zoom across to St. Vinny's.
Sadly, that is not true.
I hope we're sharing the video because I'm really enjoying the aesthetic here. I've got villain vibes. I'm wearing this, you know, dark for you and like white. It's like I feel like I'm the Joker. I'm gonna like put on a mask and crash your St. Vinny's gala, and we'll continue our pseudo rivalry tonight.
It sounds good. I hope so. I hope to see you there.
Awesome. Have a good event.
Cheers. Yeah. Bye.